Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrice, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest today is Joan Silber, author of Secrets of Happiness, out today from Counterpoint. To say I love Joan Silber is a gross understatement, and I am not her only fan here at Kirkus Reviews, nor worldwide. In the industry, she is well-known and deeply appreciated for writing fiction in which not a word is wasted, for exploring the unexpected connections between her characters in a way that delights, and for moving as fluidly between settings as points of view. And the dialogue, ugh. Here's a little bit from Kirkus's starred review of Secrets of Happiness. Quote, "A new novel in stories from the master of the form." Silber has her own sly and satisfying system for linked stories, plucking a character from one to helm the next, moving the narrative forward or sideways from that person's point of view. Her latest uses this form to explore all the ways money doesn't buy happiness and some of the things that actually do. The seven stories begin with and return to a character named Ethan, whose father, who travels a lot for his work in the garment industry, has a secret, a second family in Queens. So begins a journey based in New York, landing lightly in Chiang Mai, Bangkok, Dhaka, Kathmandu, and Phnom Penh before returning to Manhattan, end quote. I'm going to take a little bit out here because I don't want to step on your experience of discovering this great book for yourself. But here's the kicker from our review, talking about the last line of the novel, which, quote, echoes the great Grace Paley, to whom Silber is so close in spirit and voice. We'll be talking with Joan Silber soon. But first, in this sponsored interview, I'm talking with author Jessamine Stanley about Yoke, My Yoga of Self-Acceptance, coming soon from Workmen. And this is another book I love. Stanley is an internationally acclaimed voice in wellness, highly sought after for her insights on 21st century yoga and intersectional identity. She is the founder of The Underbelly, an inclusive wellness community and streaming app, co-host of the podcast Dear Jessamine, and co-founder of We Go High, a North Carolina-based cannabis justice initiative. In her authorial debut, Everybody Yoga, she wrote about how to do yoga. In Yoke, she goes deeper into the what and the why and the who, picking up where Everybody Yoga left off. And we're going to talk about it all right now. Welcome, Jessamine, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
I am honored to get the chance to speak with you about Yoke, My Yoga of Self-Acceptance. I mean, this is the follow-up to your authorial debut, which was Everybody Yoga. What's the relationship between Everybody Yoga and Yoke?
So I have to tell you, I knew I was going to have to write Yoke while I was still writing Everybody Yoga. Because in the process of writing that book, I was like, man, this is barely scraping the surface of what yoga is. Like when you first start practicing yoga, you're worried about like, what mat should I use? What style should I try? What are the poses like? But then once you actually start practicing, you recognize that that's not really yoga. That's like a pretty small piece of the puzzle. The biggest yoga really happens when you start to see all the different pieces of yourself. And it's always things that you've been hiding from. It's everything that you don't like about yourself, everything that you try to pretend doesn't exist. And for me in my own yoga practice, it's meant accepting so many things that frankly, I don't want to accept. I don't want to accept my internalized racism. I don't want to accept my slut shaming. I don't like thinking about the fact that I appropriate other cultures. It's not fun to think about, but ultimately that is the yoga. And it's so much of what we practice in the postures, the balance, the grounding, the strengthening, the flexibility. That is what we are practicing also in the acceptance of self. And so I wanted to write something that actually speaks to the difficulty of that experience, but also the triumph of it and what it can really look like to accept yourself. So Everybody Yoga and yoke are meant to go together. They yoke together, so to speak.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for bringing it all the way home. Thank you.
It was like, I like a circle.
This book kind of it exploded my pea brain. You know, it really expanded my understanding of what yoga is, what yoga can be. You know, it made me think for me, like, reading is yoga, or, you know, my time in the backyard is yoga. You know, it just felt so true. It was like an overwhelming revelation.
That's really, I'm so glad that you said that, though, because that's really so much of it, is that, you know, I don't think that practicing yoga postures and practicing, like, formal meditation, I'm using air quotes around formal and around meditation, honestly, but I don't think that that is necessarily for everybody. But I do think that everyone has a practice of the yoga of everyday life, so that ultimately, everything is yoga. Like, anything and everything is yoga. I always think the yoga teachers that are the most profound in my life are the people that I'm in relationships with and the people that I love. They are really teaching me about how to find balance and find flexibility and to take the good with the bad and to accept things as they are. And that the most profound yoga practice is not like trying to practice scorpion handstand or whatever on your yoga mat. It's not like handstands on the beach or whatever thing you see on Instagram. The real yoga is like somebody cuts you off in traffic and you would like have to try not to have road rage on them. Like, it's when you are in a difficult situation with somebody that you love and you reach that crossroads of like, there's no good, there's no bad, there's no right, there's no wrong, we're just here. That's what yoga is. And that it comes up in all these different moments that you don't expect it to, but like, ultimately, everyone is practicing yoga all the time.
Yeah, and furthermore, like, another profound thought that I'm carrying with me from reading this book is that my understanding is that your practice is your practice and can only ever be your practice. Like, you can't take somebody else's practice any more than they can take yours. It is, like, about you, for you, comes from within, and it is enough.
That is exactly right. And I think that, you know, we can get into a whole other conversation about this, and maybe just to who's listening, saying you can find this in the book Yoke, but there's a conversation to be had around, like, the way that yoga was introduced when it came to America and the fact that yoga is very much embedded in the same soil that America is was built in, and that means that the fetishization and the exploitation and the disrespect for other cultures has led to a world in which I think a lot of people try to appropriate an idea of a yoga practice as opposed to actually embodying their own yoga practice, and that everyone's yoga is unique to them, and that it's not like my yoga is my yoga, your yoga is your yoga. And I don't want to get into, we can have another conversation about non-duality versus duality, but I do think that, like, there's this singularity to it of owning your own truth. That means that if you are really practicing yoga, there's no need to appropriate anyone else's anything because you're living your own truth.
Right. And, you know, furthermore, I like how you draw readers' attention to, like, in like, white supremacist culture, that you draw attention to the word supremacy. And it's like, what happens when, you know, like, we get yoga in American hands, right? And it turns into, like, a thing that can be won, or I can out yoga you, or, like, you can be the supreme yogi, you know, the best, the most followers, the most mats with your face on it, if that's a thing, you know, like,
oh,
that kind
goodness,
of, like,
exactly.
Like, winning yoga. You
know? Literally. No, it's like, I will be the king of yoga. And, like, it just becomes yet another place for us to experience and practice inequality and to be. And the idea of supremacy is so deeply embedded in our world. And now it's global. It's not even something that just exists in certain areas. And I think that it gets to be something where it's like, oh, I don't want to think about that. I don't like that. That's a hard idea. And the reality is that we're all just going to be stuck in place forever if we don't accept that, yes, supremacy. And I would go so far as to say specifically white supremacy, but right. I do think that the idea of triumphing over another human being, that has polluted what it means to just be and to just exist exactly as you are. And so much of the practice of yoga, I think, has been really cloistered around this idea that, like, you are taking care of, it's just about you. You know, it's just about, like, you're taking care of yourself. And it's not an idea that can affect the world overall. And I think that the more that we see our yoga practices as all encompassing, in everything, never ending, and that we're constantly practicing it, the more that we're able to find that same stability and grounding and flexibility in the most difficult parts of life, and that we're able to heal these wounds that are so deep in our society, things that I think we're all collectively waking up to. And that there's this kind of this question of, like, what do you do about this? Like, what do I do about white supremacy? Like, how do I deal with gender inequity? Like, transphobia, how we solve that? Like, and it comes through acceptance of self. And that if you can't accept yourself, there's no way that you can accept anyone else. And there's no way that you can harness compassion in the world. So that ultimately this practice of yoga is really quite political, and it's very revolutionary. And it's something that it extends not just off your yoga mat and not just into your life, but really into the rest of the world, so that we can all live in harmony together.
Speaking of extend, we're about to go into extra innings on this conversation, but I do want to ask you before we wrap, is there anything else you would like our listeners to know about yoke or anything?
You know, I think that I have a lot that I can say, and I think that you can find anything that you're looking for about me or about yoke at my website, justinstanley.com, and you can find yoga classes with me at theunderbelly.com. But I really feel like, as far as yoga is concerned, even like once you're reading the book and you're like, there's a lot of difficult themes in the book, and there's a lot that can be, I think, hard to stomach and hard to accept. But I genuinely, more than anything, just want for anyone who has been impacted by this to know that you are enough exactly as you are right now. Everything that you are doing is exactly where it needs to be. You are offering something to this world that no one else can offer, and you were made the way that you were on purpose. And we need you. I need you. We need you to be you just like you are. That's it.
Jessamine, thank you so much for joining me today on Fully Booked.
Thank you so much for having me, Megan. It's really been a pleasure, truly.
That was Jessamine Stanley, author of Yoke, My Yoga of Self-Acceptance, coming in June from Workman. After the break, Joan Silber joins us from New York to discuss secrets of happiness.
This message is brought to you by Don Pizzarello, author of collected stories, Angel of Mercy, and Seven Others. This debut collection offers a series of disconcerting tales in which characters experience horror that's more metaphysical than palpable. Our reviewer called it, quote, a stellar series with sublimely understated frights, both brooding and indelible, end quote. In many ways, this book is populated by prisoners, beginning with Angel of Mercy, in which quadriplegic Marcus Ambrose is at the mercy of his caretaker wife, Elena. Angel of Mercy was awarded first prize in a short story contest conducted by The Invention Factory and an Editor's Choice Prize from AuthorStand.com. A reviewer applauds Pizzarello's ability to, quote, end every story with a punch, end quote. Collected Stories by Don Pizzarello is available now in ebook on Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn. This message is brought to you by Claire Luana, author of the YA fantasy series opener, The Confectioner's Guild. A magic cupcake, a culinary killer, the perfect recipe for murder. Ren knew her sweet treats could work wonders, but she never knew they could work magic. She barely has time to wrap her head around the stunning revelation when the head of the prestigious Confectioner's Guild falls down dead before her, poisoned by her cupcake. Now facing murder charges in a magical world she doesn't understand, Ren must discover the true killer or face the headsman's axe. With the help of a handsome inspector and several new friends, Ren just might manage to learn the ropes, master her new powers, and find out who framed her. But when their search for clues leads to a deep-rooted conspiracy that goes all the way to the top, she realizes that the Guildmaster isn't the only one at risk of death by chocolate. If Ren can't bring the powerful culprit to justice, she and her friends will meet a bittersweet end. The Confectioner's Guild is a delicious YA fantasy mystery. If you like spunky chefs and twisty mysteries with a drizzle of romance, then Claire Luana's scrumptious tale is sure to satisfy your sweet tooth. Kirkus Reviews called it, quote, an enchanting mystery that will engage readers' senses and capture their imaginations, end quote, and named it one of the best books of 2018 for indie. You can find The Confectioner's Guild in paperback and hardback through indiebound.org or an ebook for free download on all platforms.
Welcome, Joan, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me.
I'm so happy to be here.
This is such a pleasure. Right before we started rolling, I just disclosed that you were one of my first interviews for this podcast when I was just a wee podcaster. And you were one of my favorite guests then.
Thank you.
So I'm very excited to discuss your latest novel. It's called Secrets of Happiness. We'll start it with the classic, what is this book about?
It's always hard for me to say that because my books are always in pieces. But the premise is Ethan, who is a young lawyer in New York, happens to be gay, discovers that his father has long had a secret other family with two sons, with a Thai woman whom he met when he was traveling for the garment business, which he's been in. In unfolding that, his quite excellent mother is completely shocked that this has been going on for 17 years. She goes to Thailand, where the family, the other family is from, but she's curious about it, and undergoes a number of changes herself. And the story unfolds from there. We follow the Thai American family in one chapter. We follow remote connections connected to them. We make all sorts of circles over time and end back with Ethan in the last section.
He does have a quite remarkable mother, Abby. And I pulled just from the, I think this is on maybe page two of the first section of this book. There's a couple little sentences. My mother left us alone. This is Ethan. My mother left us alone. She taught school all day. She didn't need to see kids every minute. And then she'd burst forth at dinner, taking an interest, asking my friends the very questions they wanted to answer. Mike told her he believed in reincarnation, which I didn't even know. That I pull this passage, first of all, in tribute to Abby, who is one of my favorite characters of this book, but also because I want to ask you, Joan, what are the very questions you want to answer? I'd settle for one or two.
Oh, that I want to answer about this book. Oh, that's interesting. One of the questions that people always ask me that in some ways I'm most comfortable with is why I have chosen for the last five books this form of interconnected sections. So do you want to ask me that?
Why have you chosen this form of interconnected sections, Joan?
I did it because a lot of people think, oh, I started in linked stories and now I'm really doing novels.
But yeah.
A lot of people think that's kind of an apprentice form and what you really want to do is a more unified novel. But I started with those and then moved to this. And one of the reasons that it's been for me a good form is that I always want it to be, you know, small and big at the same time. Mm. I love the intimacy of the close gaze. I love doing very specific interior moments with my characters. But I always wanted to somehow expand on that in a way that felt true to me. And going from character to character, place to place, to some extent, different time spans, allowed me to get bigger in a way that was still faithful to, you know, what I could do.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, for your last novel, Improvement, you took us from Harlem to Turkey. Here we're going spatially, we're going from New York City to many parts of Asia. Actually, I wanted to ask, have you traveled extensively through Asia or?
I have. In the past 20 years, I have, and I love it. I'm dying to go back again.
Yeah. One of the things I think you do so well is just really draw our attention to something we know, but sometimes we lose sight of, which is that, you know, like all of these mysterious links and chains of, you know, this web of interpersonal relationships that, you know, spreads through all of our lives. What interests you in exploring these connections?
Well, I'm a very urban person. I mean, I lived my whole adult life in New York City, and it's impossible to walk very far down the street in New York without meeting someone you know from, you know, one of your other lives. I mean, that's a part of our experience, you know, and and someone asked me if I like to eavesdrop a lot. And of course I do. who does not? But I wanted that sense of, you know, there's a thousand things going on at once. That's a really important sense to me. And I also, I'm kind of against what I would call parochialism, which means, you know, the way you do it is the way it's done. And obviously that's been very dangerous for us as a people and for everyone.
Oh, geez. So, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're just recovering from some of that, I think, although, you know, it's not like everything has changed utterly. But I wanted to get that sense of there's a lot of things going on at once at the same time. I think that's a, you know, a belief of mine. I think it's less narcissistic than a more single line novel, although, of course, I've loved them intensely. But, I wanted to get that there's some idea of mine underneath that method of doing it.
Right. So what was going on in your life? What was going on in the world for the span of time in which you wrote this book?
Well, I actually began it in 2016.
Oh.
So the election was going on.
Yes.
I began it in March. So it took a while to get full steam. And of course, I was entirely shocked at the way that election turned out. I did not expect that. So some of that is in the book. And I think the place where it hit me most strongly is one of the sections is called Bud, and it's about a guy whose parents, he's in his 60s in current time, but he is the child of parents who were members of the John Birch Society, which is a big thing in the 50s and 60s, very ultra-right. And the ultra-right in those days was very anti-communist, which
right.
doesn't have to be so strongly now, but had a lot of the same ideas, you know, of American exceptionalism and our, you know, our need to correct all those things. I wanted to write about coming out of that. And if he of course, is a great runaway and does all sorts of things to get out of that and, you know, has a whole different life. One of my favorite moments with him that I was happy when I made it up is he is sort of drifting around, driving a cab. He's in his 20s. And he meets with the rest of his family won't even see him anymore, but he meets with his sister. And his sister thinks he has something to do with unions, which isn't even true. But he makes that up. He decides, yes, I'm an organizer for a union because he has a friend who does that. And then he ends up doing it. He lies himself into that role, as we often do in life, right? You make something up and then you sort of discover yourself doing it. Mm-hmm. So he becomes an organizer for many years. And I love doing that. That was fun for me.
I love that moment too. And it just highlights there are many characters in this book. You could say they make, if you're going to be moralistic, they make questionable decisions or they make decisions that are against the law. But it's so clear to me reading this book that it really depends on your vantage when you're looking at such decisions, whether you think it's righteous or wrong.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Because yeah. That's just what I want by moving the vantage too, which keeps moving around. So you see it from one side, you see it from the other side. I was thinking recently, you know, there are these great Japanese woodblock prints. Like, we know the Great Wave, Hokusai's The Great Wave.
Yes.
And that's actually from a whole series that's pictures of Mount 36 views of Mount Fuji. And Mount Fuji is very, this little triangular shape in the far distance in the Great Wave. And in other parts of that series, Mount Fuji's right in the forefront. So I love that. You know, I love seeing things from different angles.
Joan, you're constantly blowing my mind. I honestly, the first question I wrote when I started reading this novel was like, why are you so fucking good at this? But then I was like, I really need to move beyond that as an interviewer. You know, I was like, that's pretty basic, you know? So I'm trying to take us different places. One place I'd like to take us is down to the level of the sentence. Like, I think you could write a perfect sentence. The first one at random that I would pull is, reading wasn't something he could do anymore. I mean, like, this is actually about Ethan's father, what happens to him. It just, reading wasn't something he could do anymore. It tells me so much with so few words so clearly. It just hits you like a ton of bricks.
I do knock myself out over my sentences, and I... It's just sort of the way I write. I mean, I work very slowly, and every day I go back to what I wrote the day before, and I think, oh no, what I really meant was, it isn't even that I'm thinking in terms of perfecting the language. I'm thinking in terms of, you know, getting deeper into what I wanted to say, or getting closer into what I want to describe. So I love doing that. When I was young in college, I wanted to be a poet. Mm. So I have some, I think the world has been saved from a bad poet by my not doing that, but my practice in going over every word comes from those days. And so I like that. That's actually pleasurable for me.
And another thing that was pleasurable for me as your reader was noticing that sometimes, you know, you'll introduce dialogue, we've got a story going already, and then kind of just like glancingly, seemingly, you situate us in whatever time or place this story is being told. It's just like slow clap.
Thank you. I'm a great fan of Alice Munro. Mm-hmm. I'm thrilled if anybody ever compares me to her. But she does that. She can float. I mean, what she does is something that starts as a sort of generalized thing. Then we get a kind of mini scene that is very specific and placed. So I love doing that. That's fun.
I was trawling through Goodreads, which has been, you know, capturing the popular imagination, especially in recent days. They're having all sorts of controversies over there. But I saw a book of yours that I've not had the pleasure of reading is The Art of Time in Fiction, As Long as It Takes. It's nonfiction. One of the reviewers said on that he loved it because he sees you two as peas in a pod, both obsessed with time. Would you say time in fiction is an obsession of yours? Or
yes. I love that about. I mean, when I wrote that book, because Charles Baxter, who's a friend, was overseeing this series of wonderful books from Grey Wolf, where you talked about a specific craft topic. But when I started to do the book, I thought, oh, fiction is always about time. You know, first this happened, then that happened. That's the difference of narrative from, you know, the lyric moment. I mean, fiction is always moving in time. And I was at the moment I was writing it, which is a while ago, more than a decade ago, thinking about Buddhism a lot. I, you know, my interest in it was particularly strong. And I was thinking about, you know, Buddhism is all about impermanence, you know, so fiction is really dealing with that. You know, nothing stops. It keeps, and it's not going to stay the same, and it's going to shift. And I loved that. I loved thinking about that.
To tease out the word shift, let's shift back to Secrets of Happiness. I mean, another fairly basic, but question I want an answer to. Why the title, Secrets of Happiness? And also, did you ever consider a definite article in there, The Secrets of Happiness?
Oh, no, I never thought of that, actually. I don't think that occurred to me. I was a little worried it was going to sound like a self-help book anyway, so maybe the D would have made it even worse that way. But I thought of it, I had finished, in fact, this always is true. The first chapter I always think is just going to be a story, and then, you know, I think, oh no, there's more I can do here. So, but when I finished the first part, I thought, oh, it's obviously it's about secrets because this guy has had this, you know, hidden other family. And then it's also about the secrets to happiness in the sense of the key to happiness, which in some, you know, general, you know, not so slap happy way, the mother kind of comes back with. The mother is the one, you know, at the end of the chapter, the mother says to Ethan, tell your sister not to worry. The sister's worried about money or something like that. So I wanted both senses of secrets in that sense. And of course, I like having happiness in the title.
Right. Has your career made you happy, would you say?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's funny, you know, when you're young, you think, oh, if I could only get this or that, you know, I'd be happy forever. And usually that's not so, you know, most things are. To some extent, once the you know, I mean, my career started going well after Ideas of Heaven, which is a while ago, but once I was working in the same form. But the improvement did the best. Improvement really completely amazed me. I did not expect any of that. And I am pretty cheerful. I really am. No, it's, I mean, you have that forever, no matter what happens, once you've gotten that kind of praise from the world. So yes, it has made me happy.
I was there the night the National Book Critics Circle selected Improvement as the fiction winner. What was that night like?
Oh, it was totally. I was saying. I mean, I had my own idea of who else was going to win, who would have deserved it. You know.
Yeah.
I had you know wonderful people you know against me in that competition, and I went with my friend C.J. Reibel, who's a wonderful writer, who's going to be interviewing me for my book tour.
Oh.
C.J. lives in Milwaukee. We're friends from Warren Wilson, where we've both taught for years. And C.J. was staying with me with his wife, who had a terrible cold that night, so she couldn't come with us. But he and my friend Myra were my company, and my editor was there and stuff. So when they said my name, I mean, I really was complete. I just heard this hooting. CJ's a particularly good hooter. So I heard him really loud. I heard my editor was hooting. You know, I just was completely amazed. I really was, you know, I had a speech. I mean, I had prepared that it might happen. But, and then I was wearing higher heels than I usually wear. And I was, the stairway is sort of dark going up to the stage.
Right.
I thought, oh, I'm going to fall. I'm going to just, you know, so if there's any pictures, I'm like holding onto the wall as I go up. But I was just staggered. It was really, you know, amazing and surprising and wonderful. You know?
All the photos I've seen, you look quite poised in them after the fact.
Oh good.
Later in the evening. So are you and CJ going to do the online, the virtual event kind of?
Yes, he's my third, I'm doing the Zoom book tour. I've never actually been on a real book tour in my life. Nobody's ever sent me, you know, any place further away than Brooklyn. Not really, you know. When they were doing lots of book tours was not when I was selling well, you know, which is a while ago. So I haven't, I've read in many bookstores, but not in any kind of design tour. So now I'm like going all over the country with Zoom. It's great. So I'm going to Milwaukee with CJ, in, you know, the second week in May. I'm quite thrilled about this.
Second week in May. Which day?
I don't think I can tell you right
okay.
now.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
We'll put it in the show notes just to make sure that all of our listeners know that they can go see you.
Actually, I have it on my calendar. It is May 11th.
May 11th. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, you heard it here first, folks. May 11th.
Yeah.
I'll be there. Okay, kind of a complicated thought I just had. Is money an enemy of happiness generally? Is religion a friend? Can you speak generally about anything, or is it always shifting?
Well, certainly it's always qualified. It's funny because there's a lot of stuff about money in the book. And the second chapter was published as a story under the title Love and Money.
Oh.
I think it's a complication of happiness. I don't, and certainly, you know, people are unhappy if they're really broke, but they're not, but it's not, you know, the father has plenty of money and he hasn't bought himself a good deal, I think.
Right.
I have a qualified opinion of it, but I certainly don't think, and I think this is not really in the story, but I think that rich people tend to value money and think it's more important than poor people do. I don't mean that poor people don't care about it. Of course they
sure.
do and spend a lot of time thinking about it, but they understand they can get along without it or that they do. And certainly like in the Depression, the people who jumped out of buildings because they were so upset that the stock market fell were not very poor people.
Right.
And almost none of them were African-American people, in fact, statistically. So people who, do you know what I mean? I just feel like there's a certain resourcefulness required about money. But it does come up a lot in people considering their happiness and also just what determines their lives.
Right. It's interesting because Joe, the half-brother of Ethan, he gets the second section of the book. There's a line, one of the big questions of my father, their shared father, one of the big questions of my father's life had been, what can money buy? And of course, you know, we all know money can't buy you happiness, or so we've been told. So,
And the sentence that he thinks later is that his father likes to pay for things. Mm. The father feels that it's, which is one reason he's taken up with this perfectly nice Thai woman who loves him in her way. But the fact that he has secured her through money, I mean, she's not a prostitute, but he has provided for her.
Yeah.
It makes it feel more secure to him. Mm-hmm. And I think there are lots of people like that who feel that money is a more sure bond than a lot of other things. I don't think that myself. Mm.
Nor do I. And the more I'm thinking about it, like the two questions ago, I'm like, you know, it does seem there's like a particular fear, you know, on the note of those who jumped out of the windows during the Great Depression. Like, there's so much, there seems to be, it's so freighted. There seems to be so much fear, especially with like, you know, people who are rich, but they're not like mega super billionaire Jeff Bezos in a bunker rich, you know? But like people who are rich, once you have acquired enough, like the fear of losing it, I think can, I've seen it perpetuate some ugly behaviors, I'd call them.
Yeah, and there's more of a sense of public disgrace associated with it.
Right.
Which the rest of us don't have, you know?
Right. Yeah. For my own part, I know I'm well aware of my own insignificance, and I love it.
Yes.
It's quite liberating.
Yes, it is quite liberating. I agree entirely.
When you look back on your earliest works, how do you regard them? Fondly?
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, I have a weird career in that. The first book did really well. It won the Pen Hemingway Award. And then the second book didn't. And I had 13 years after that when nobody would publish me, when no one would publish a book. I had stories published. So I've had a very zigzagging career. I feel like my voice has not changed that much, but my angle and what I'm telling, I mean, the earlier books seem narrower, and I feel like the world was smaller then. I think most people were writing in a smaller kind of realm. Mm. So that's my view. You know, I don't hate them, but I'm different now.
Right, right. There's one thing glancingly, there's an older woman mentioned in this book as still being with it. And like that just really cracked me up. Do you care to comment? Because that's
I don't even remember writing that, but I hope that describes myself. Absolutely. Definitely.
It's funny, I have a 104-year-old Italian aunt who still lives in Canarsie, Brooklyn. And you know, that's what they say about her. And she could, for her whole life, she'll run circles around you. It's like,
yes.
How dare you? How dare you? You recognize her mighty intelligence all along with, oh, she's still got it.
That's very heartening to hear.
So, I mean, we really have done some gymnastics in this conversation. I'm pretty pleased. Where else should we go?
I didn't know I was going to direct this.
always surprising here at the Fully Booked Podcast.
I'm trying to think other questions people have asked me that I've liked. One question that I do get asked, my cousin who read the book just asked, like, which are the characters I identify with? None of the story is about my own experience, but I probably do. I love Rachel. I think she's a great character.
Yeah.
And she's described by herself as the old broad at the insurance division that she works in, and you know, as the one who knows what's going on. So I guess I like that. And I like Bud. I like Bud because he's run away from something and made a life for himself. Oh, and he has what is one of my favorite lines in this story. Bud has led this very long and ambling life, but he ends up working for an NGO in Cambodia, which has a lot of NGOs. And he's communicating with Rachel, whom he loves, by Skype. And he actually, he's in his 60s, he's looking out at the Mekong, and he thinks something to the effect of, I couldn't ask for more than I have. And I love that sentiment, and I love the sense of him, you know, looking out at this, you know, ancient settlement on the water when he thinks that. Mm. So he's a favorite character.
Another favorite line of mine is Rachel is connected to Rachel. I don't know if the word ward applies or if we even use it anymore, but Rachel has a young woman living with her named Nadia, who is the daughter yes. of one of her exes. And she's mm-hmm. in her early 20s. And I like her very much. Nadia has this line. She's speaking with Rachel. She said, How do people make these colossal bargains about what they decide to put up with? And I wrote in the margin, I said, this is the question of the book and also of life, by the way.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Oh, I hadn't even thought of that as applying to the whole book, but it really does. Because the son, Joe, asks that a lot about his mother, Nook, the Thai woman who you know, made a bargain by going with this wealthy older man. And it is like, what are the bargains that we, because you can't get everything you want. I mean, yeah. you know that. So how do you have a life that doesn't have unseemly compromise in it, which you know, is a struggle for all of us. Yes, I'm glad you pulled that out as a line. I love that.
Oh, Joan, I love talking with you. And I see now that we've crept all the way up to our timeline. And I would just want to say, is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know?
No, we've covered it. We've done it all.
Well, I couldn't feel better. And I just want to thank you so much, Joan, for joining me today on Fully Booked.
Thank you. This has been great. I've loved this.
That was Joan Silber, author of Secrets of Happiness, out now from Counterpoint. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks and books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews.
This message is brought to you by Global Animal, publisher of the new novel, Snowflake. In this climate thriller, Ben Wallace is a brilliant teenager who becomes increasingly alarmed by the climate crisis and outraged by the president's destruction of the natural world. After his house nearly burns down and his asthmatic younger sister ends up hospitalized due to wildfire pollution, a radical idea takes root in Ben's head. In order to save the world, he'll have to kill the man who's hurting it the most, the climate change denying president of the United States. Publishers Weekly, Book Life, named Snowflake an editor's choice and described the novel as, quote, a ripped from the headlines stunner, impossible for readers to put down, end quote. Blue Ink awarded Snowflake its notable book seal and called it, quote, a compelling portrait of a young man in crisis, end quote. Snowflake by Arthur Gion is available now in paperback and ebook on Amazon. This message is brought to you by Helen Martin Block, author of The Shoemaker's Daughter, a novel. In her debut novel, Helen Martin Block tells the desperate tale of a couple attempting to survive the horrors of Nazi occupation. Erin Matusiewski is captured after the German invasion of Poland. Erin is doubly terrified of his captors, for he's not just a Polish soldier, he's also Jewish, and he keeps that fact a secret. Erin is a skilled shoemaker, and this useful talent saves him for months. His cover is blown, though, and he is shipped back to Poland for slave labor and certain death. When he arrives, he's reunited with the girl he fell in love with before the war, the indomitable Gittel. Against all reason and in the ruins of their former lives, they embark on a love affair. When their marriage results in a daughter, it forces them to make terrible choices, and the cost of survival may be more than they're willing to pay. Our reviewer notes that Block, quote, illustrates not only the desolate, selfish calamity of the war, but also the hard, unsentimental love that takes root in such a setting, end quote. They go on to call The Shoemaker's Daughter, quote, an engaging story of love in the worst of circumstances, end quote. The novel has been praised by groups such as Sarasota Congressional Church, the Jewish Book Council, Goodreads, and Fairfield County Libraries. The Shoemaker's Daughter, a novel, is available now in paperback on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and at independent bookstores.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books. Right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks in books for the week. We have Young Readers editors Vicki Smith and Laura Simeon. nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau and fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Starting with Vicky, what's your choice for us?
My pick for this week is an absolutely gorgeous picture book called Wishes. It's by Muyen T. Van, and it's illustrated by Victor Nye. And the text is this very, very simple string of wishes, wishes on the part of various different, elements in the story. They're not even people. But to give you a taste, the night wished it was quieter. The bag wished it was deeper. The light wished it was brighter. The dream wished it was longer. And this text, you know, by itself is pretty enigmatic, but the visual story that Nye tells makes everything clear. It's a family, a Vietnamese family, who are preparing to leave their home. They are packing their bags and saying goodbye to what they love and getting onto a boat for a perilous sea journey. And at the end of it, they are picked up by an ocean, well, not an ocean liner, actually. It's bigger than the boat that they're on, but it's a fishing boat. And they are taken to a new place, a city where they are going to start a new and different life. The author's note describes how she left Vietnam and their family went to Hong Kong. And I don't know whether this is Hong Kong or whether it is a fanciful city that Nye has created, but it's a contrast to where they've left, and it is certainly hopeful. But what is really strong about this book is that it's so clear that this family is leaving what they love. They are not taking this journey lightly. It's scary, but the family's love is what keeps them going and will help them when they get to their new place. It's just gorgeous.
Thank you, Vicky. I'm definitely going to get this one for my son. I can tell by the cover how beautiful it is. And I like, my son is just kind of getting into this, or not figuring out, but asking questions about this, the idea of refugees, and trying to understand it. And obviously it's beyond his comprehension, but it seems like this could be something to kind of further that comprehension.
Yeah, I think so. It really is. I mean, you'd say open-ended. It's very porous. It gives kids who have different levels of understanding plenty of ways in, and it will start a conversation with you, because there are some scary spots in it. But the fact that the text is so quiet, and the fact that the family is together the whole time, should be able to carry kids through and help them understand what's going on.
Okay. That's perfect.
Vicky's pick for the week is Wishes by Muyen T. Van and illustrated by Victor Nye. Thank you, Vicky, for that choice. Next, we have Laura's choice. Laura, what have you picked for us?
So I picked Luck of the Titanic by Stacy Lee. And Stacy Lee is known for writing great historical fiction featuring Chinese-American characters who are usually pretty much erased from a lot of historical fiction. And so they're also not just educational, but just really compelling and very fresh, you know, that you don't feel like she's doing these huge info dumps. And that is true with her latest. It's about Val and Jamie Luck, hence the title, who are her twins, who had a white English mother and a Chinese father. And both their parents have died. Jamie has been off working at sea, on board, you know, various ships as a crew member. And Val had been a lady's maid to this woman who was planning to sail on the Titanic, but dies shortly before, you know, it's supposed to set sail. And, you know, she wants to be with her brother, her last remaining family member. And so she doesn't exactly stow away. She attempts to board legally using the ticket she had that she was going to accompany, you know, the woman with, but is told, like, wait, don't you know about the Chinese Exclusion Act? They'll never let you in when we get to New York, you know, forget it. And the backstory, the two of them had been trained as acrobats, and they had worked as acrobats to help support the family. So she does this very exciting acrobatic maneuver, gets on board, ends up posing as this woman, the widow, and, you know, finds and this ally who's this American fashion designer who wants her to wear her clothes, basically hide in plain sight, right? Finds her brother. And it's just this fascinating look behind the scenes of what it was like to be on the Titanic in all areas of the ship, you know, all social classes, below deck, first class. And the thing is, you know what happens to the Titanic, but you don't know what's going to happen to these characters. And that's the really suspenseful part. And I just have to add, a lot of Titanic books and you know, media representation doesn't show there actually were people of different backgrounds. There were a lot of Syrian passengers, there were Chinese passengers. So it is very historically accurate and just a really gripping read.
That sounds really great. And it ties in really nicely with the book I'm going to tell you about in a few minutes, which also has a shipwreck, although it's not the Titanic. I think it mentions the Titanic in a kind of Chekhov's gun on the wall kind of way, and then another ship goes down later. So hold that thought.
Ooh, perfect.
Laura's pick for the week is Luck of the Titanic by Stacy Lee. Thank you, Laura, for that choice. I'm a huge Stacy Lee fan, if you didn't already know it. Okay, next, nonfiction. Eric, what have you chosen for us?
I chose a book called Nine Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever. And it is the latest book from John McWhorter, the renowned linguist who writes a lot of good popular books on linguistics. He wrote Words on the Move, Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, and a bunch of other books. And it's kind of our reviewer noted that it's characteristic McWhorter, and that it's dense and breezy at the same time. He kind of jumps from one reference to another. So it's a really good book. You can read straight through, but also just pick up and read passages and, you know, pick up some good cocktail party fodder. And he's just a really good writer. He has these insights that a lot of people won't think about. And this kind of book, I know everyone on this podcast is a word nerd in some way. So I think anybody who enjoys language would enjoy this. It's a good combination of historical analysis of etymologies and kind of amusing anecdotes that demonstrate what he's talking about.
Eric, I can't wait to read this. I really like McWhorter's linguistics books, but I wanted to recommend The Secret Life of Pronouns by James W. Pennebaker, because I feel like there's a lot of parallels. You know, they're both academics who write accessibly for, you know, lay audience. And it's another book that just takes one small element of language and then talks about its social context and usage. And it's just so fascinating. And again, a combination of really interesting anecdotes and then all his like statistical analysis. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a great one. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Eric's pick for the week is Nine Nasty Words, English in the Gutter, Then, Now, and Forever by John McWhorter. Thank you, fellow word nerd, for that pick. Thanks, Eric. Finally, we have fiction with Lori. Lori, what do you have this week?
I would like to recommend a book called Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. And when I was thinking about this, I was starting to feel a little bit bad because I think that I've been recommending things lately that have been so great. And every week I'm like, oh, this is the best thing I've read in ages. And this is the best thing I've read in ages. And I guess I've just had a run of really good things, but I feel like this is the book that I'm going to be recommending to people this summer. It's just like a perfect, you know, get way into it sort of summer read that will last you a long time and you'll never want to emerge from. I don't know if you guys remember Maggie Shipstead. She's an author whose earlier books I also really loved. Her first novel, Seating Arrangements, took place over one weekend while one of the characters was getting married on a small island in New England. Her second novel, Astonish Me, takes place in the world of ballet. So they're both very sort of tight and specific. This novel is almost 600 pages. It has two different timelines. It goes from 1908, when a ship is being christened in Glasgow, and then we go along with the owner of the ship and the captain of the ship. And then the captain has an affair with a woman on the boat who gets pregnant and has twins. And then the boat goes down. I'm like, this all happens right at the beginning. I'm not really giving anything away. And actually I found that this kind of backdrop was a little bit, took me a little while to get into it. And then the twins are the main characters of the book, especially the girl Marion, who winds up in Montana. And on the same day that Lindbergh crosses the Atlantic, she sees an air show and she falls in love with flying. And this is sort of the crux of the book, how she becomes an Amelia Earhart-like pilot. And, you know, how she gets the money in Montana in the 1920s to learn to fly. And, you know, she moves to Alaska. She does all these incredible things. She spends time in England during World War II. Just her whole life as a pilot. And it is fascinating. And you know from the beginning that eventually she's going to go missing, like Amelia Earhart. She's trying to do a great circle, go all the way around the earth, crossing both poles. And then there's this whole other timeline in the present about an actress in the present day who is a sort of a teen sensation. And now she's been a tabloid scandal. And now she's trying to have a comeback by playing Marion in a film. So that stream is much less of the book than the part just about Marion, but it adds a really nice counterpoint. And it's just so complex the way Shipstead weaves together all these places and times and characters, and they're all really engaging once you get past the beginning, which is a little bit of throat clearing to give you background that's going to be important later. So it's really, really great.
Lori, this sounds fabulous. I belong to a book group of very generous readers, and I joined, well, because I like talking about books, but because it helps me sort of gives me a reason to read the occasional grown-up book. Mm-hmm. And these friends are wonderful, and they've become fans of Elizabeth Wien, who writes wonderful books for young adults and very often have aviators and aviatrixes in them. This is a long way of getting to, they have become great fans of yours, Lori, ever okay. since I said, my colleague Lori says everybody should read Deacon King Kong. And so now that you are saying that everybody should read The Great Circle, I will be able to tie their love of Elizabeth Wien and their admiration for you together for a summer pick. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Thank you, Vicki. That's so nice. And actually, I didn't say this, but I have been thinking in my head that to me, this is the Deacon King Kong of this summer, like the book that you just want to sit in a hammock or something and read for hours on end.
Woohoo!
Lori's pick for the week is Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. Thank you, Lori, for that choice. Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you all so much for joining us. Please join us again next week when my guest will be Tracy Sorrell, author of We Are Still Here, Native American Truths Everyone Should Know, illustrated by Frané Lissac. Really looking forward to my conversation with Tracy. But until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.